to talk a little bit this evening about metta meditation. In understanding this, we start with, we can understand and recognize about ordinary human emotions. Something we recognize in the love that a mother feels for her child, which immediately strikes us, immediately, without any mediation or explanation. We know there's something beautiful. We know something which is somehow essential, and we know that without it, life cannot flourish. We recognize this not just in the human realm, even in the animal realm. We can recognize a mother's love just as clearly and just as beautifully. And it's in that warm embrace of acceptance, of care, of love, that all of us began. All of us, our minds started to be nurtured. Our sense of who we are started to form. Our ability to make connections, to perceive oneself and another in a relationship. All of these things began with the love of a mother for a child and of a child for a mother. And as we grow as human beings, our emotions also grow. This is part of our development. And the nature of that relationship and connection between the mother and the child changes. And we recognize that if that doesn't happen, then this is neither to the advantage of either the mother or the child. Obviously, then we have a smothering mother. We need to go with the child. Won't let them grow up, won't let them be their own person. And that kind of mature metta, it's no less strong, maybe less intense, but it's more balanced. One of the things which the Buddha noticed was that there's a certain potential for change, for growth in humanity, which is only partly realized. This is one of the crucial points of the Dhamma, that we have an innate potential to grow and to develop. Where we are now is just one spot along the journey. It's not who we are. And if we wish, we can consciously reflect on the nature of that journey, the nature of the changes which have taken place, and we can envisage what kind of changes can take place ahead of us. And it's when we consciously, as a mature decision, start to do this. This is when we start to embark on the real spiritual path according to Buddhism. Of course, most of us live our lives without doing this. We simply have emotions. We have feelings. And we just buy into them. We believe them. We identify with them. We think that we are our emotions. And there's a strong strand of modern spirituality which encourages us to do that. As I call spiritual narcissism. You find this very normally in the New Age movement. It's all about your feelings. Be your feelings.
Trust your feelings, Luke.
The Buddha. That's the words of Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's not the words of the Buddha. Feelings are impermanent. They're conditioned. They change. One day we feel one thing, the next day we feel another thing. You can't trust your feelings. How can you trust something which is changing all the time? Feelings are ambiguous. They're unclear. We could interpret them in different ways. So the Buddha didn't tell us to trust our feelings. He didn't tell us to believe our feelings. He didn't tell us to identify with our feelings instead of our thoughts. What he said was to be aware of our feelings, to understand them, to understand how they're conditioned, and to understand how to develop them in a wholesome way. So what we can trust is not our feelings. Our feelings are entirely untrustworthy. But if we develop our feelings in the right way, as part of, not the whole of, but as part of our spiritual practice, then they will help to lead to a clarity of mind. Clarity of awareness, purity of awareness. And the Buddha said that you can trust the truth that arises within the purity of awareness. It's what we call yathābhūta jñāna dasana. That's what we can trust. And so one of the things which I've noticed after teaching metta meditation, for practicing and teaching it for many years, is that there's a big difference between developing metta as a meditation practice, as a contemplative practice, and then being a person who is a very loving person. And there's been many times when I've seen people who are very, very loving, very delightful people, very caring, very joyful, beautiful to be around. They're quite inspiring people. And yet, they haven't developed that ability to reflect on the nature of their love, to stand back from it. And because of that, that sense of love which they had will very, very quickly go over to hate. It's still bound up with attachment. And it's still not something which is really developed. It's just something which is kind of there. When we develop metta as part of our spiritual practice, remember that it always comes within that context of reflection. It always has that space around it. And this is why my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai, strongly requires and encourages anyone who's starting the metta practice to begin not with loving kindness as such, but to begin by practicing equanimity, what he calls jipen glan, the mind just watching in the middle. This idea of ubeka, watching over something in Buddhism, it's not easy to attain without getting involved in something. Now, I went to this Power Shift conference the other week, and it's very kind of exciting being in the plenary session at the beginning when there were so many people there and everyone getting very rah 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 and chanting slogans and things like this. And I'm thinking, gosh, if I was as young as these guys, I would have liked doing these slogans and chanting out a few, heckling the premier and these kinds of things. It would have been fun. But I'm a monk now, so I felt a bit out of place for a while. Oh, I don't know, what am I doing here? And then I reflected on that and I thought, well, I'm here to be a witness. My job isn't the job of jumping up and down and going rah, rah, rah. My job is to be a witness to what's happening. So I felt very comfortable with that. So when we have all these different emotional responses and so on, it's your job as a Dhamma practitioner to be a witness. Not to get caught up in it. Not to believe it, not to identify with it. Just to be a witness. And if we're able to have that sense of space around things, that sense of watching over them, then that gives us the ability to choose wisely. And the Buddha's is a teaching of action, a teaching of choice, a teaching of doing. It's not a teaching of feeling things. It's a teaching of what are you going to choose? Kiriyavana. And it's only when we have enough space around things, context for them, when we can reflect on them, when we're not swept over by them, that we can choose wisely. And so when we first come to sit metta meditation, we don't just sort of sit and go off in sort of buzzing off in a feeling that we like. This is one of the questions that I asked Ajahn Mahachacha very early on. What happens if you come to sit metta meditation and you're already feeling metta? Or if you're sitting doing the equanimity practice at the beginning of the meditation and the metta comes up spontaneously, what do you do? And he said, let it go. Bring it back to equanimity. And I said, what happens if you finish your metta meditation and you just want to keep going? I can't keep meditating anymore, I've got something to do, but the feeling of metta is very strong and very beautiful. I'd like to take this as a feeling with me when I'm going off and doing my chores or having a shower. He said, no, we don't do that. Stop it. Stop the feeling of metta. Let it come back to equanimity. And it's from that basis of equanimity that we can choose to act. This is the difference between a feeling which we consciously develop in our meditation and a feeling which just arises naturally as part of the ordinary spectrum of feelings that come and go during our day. So if we're not able to develop that equanimity, that sense of space and context for our feelings, then our feeling of metta will never develop very deeply. We'll be able to do metta for a loved person very easily, but metta for a disliked person may be very difficult, but especially what will be very, very difficult will be that time when the metta nimitta wants to mature and change into the what we call the paribhaga nimitta, the very deep or powerful nimitta. And so when you start to go into upachara samadhi or even into jhana, and at those times you need an incredible amount of equanimity. Quite incredible. Until you've practiced that, You won't have any idea just how much patience is needed. All of us here have been staying in this monastery for this rains retreat, and we've been spending many hours a day doing meditation. And as we sit hour after hour after hour in our meditation, starting to understand the kind of patience, the level of equanimity that's needed to be able to develop deep samadhi. Don't kid yourself about this. Don't be in delusion. If you can't sit there very patiently for hour after hour, think about going near to samadhi or anything like that. This is not even close. This is one of the essential prerequisites. Development of equanimity, development of patience. And when we're starting the metta practice, we're doing this bare awareness, watching what happens, watching the mind, watching the body. What do we feel? We feel agitation in our body. We keep having to adjust our seat and wriggle. Do we feel pain in our body? Do we feel tired? Do we feel bored? Tension? Notice all of these different conditions. That's all they are, as conditions. So in our meditation practice, we don't try to... We talk about inquiry in meditation, but inquiry in this kind of meditation doesn't mean thinking or reflecting about these things, where have they come from, what kind of thing is it, and how do I solve it, and so on. That kind of reflective inquiry has its place, okay? But not here. What we're doing here is just an awareness practice, comprehension practice. So just to know, oh, that's what it's like. What is it like to feel a strong pain in your right shoulder? Oh, it's like that. What is it like to have one's brow knitted up with tension when you're sitting in meditation? Oh, it's like that. What is it like to finally let your stomach muscles go and relax and gut? Oh, it's like that. So you're not getting too involved in things, just watching them, okay, realizing it, and then pass on. Not trying to be too still, not staring at things, not trying to go through layers and undo things or anything like that, just trying to get an apprehension of what's going on in the mind and body. Seeing the space between thoughts. You'll never learn to do that as long as you're still interested in, attached to, identifying with the content of the thoughts themselves. If you're interested in the story, then you'll listen to the story, you won't listen to the gaps in it. But don't worry about the story, it's just a story. And again, this is the difference between Buddhist meditation practice and various kinds of therapeutic practice. And some kinds of psychotherapy, the goal is to listen to the story, see what the story has to tell you. And of course there's certain kinds of wisdom to be learned from that, to reflect on the nature of the stories that we tell ourselves, to understand why we do it in this way and not in that way and so on. And it's useful for understanding to a certain level. But as long as we keep on watching the story and listening to it, we'll never listen to it. The space between the story. Now if we can't, if the story is too insistent, then maybe we do need to listen to it. If you can't see the space, then maybe the story's got something that we need to hear. But what we're aiming for here, remember that in our meditation we have to have a very clear focus. We have to know what it is we're doing, where we're going, why we're doing it. No point in just sort of sitting there and vaguing out. It's not too, just sitting there and vaguing out is not too bad, at least you're keeping your precepts. Not hurting anybody. But you're not going to get very far with it. You have to be clear in your mind. What am I doing here? What am I sitting here for? Why am I spending all this time enduring all this pain? There's some discomfort. Why am I developing this patience? You have to have a purpose in what you're doing. So we understand our purpose is to develop that clarity of awareness. And when we see thoughts, words, we should see them coming into that space. This is one of the practices that I developed when I first started giving Dhamma talks when I was in Malaysia, because the talks were all translated. Sweeping now Venerable Pasapanya in Dhammasara used to translate the talks, and she was a very good translator. So when I would talk, mostly I was doing sutta classes in those days, and I would give an explanation of something from the sutta and then wait for her to translate it into Cantonese. And I made it a practice to just try to sit there and not have any thoughts between finishing saying one sentence and then waiting and then starting the next one. Just sit there and watch my mind. You can see the sankharas coming up, wanting to come up with a thought. And just don't buy into it. You see, it's kind of welling up, it's like bubbling, coming beneath the surface of the mind. Quite extraordinary, really. You don't really know what your thoughts are. They're just there. Where do they come from? You see this space, this blankness, like a still surface of a pool, and then some creature leaps up out of it. Is it a dolphin, or a whale, or a shark? Giant squid? You don't know where it comes from, but yet somehow there it is. So I don't need to watch this space of quiet, this space of emptiness. And then from that, when one feels secure in that, rested in that, then one brings in the practice of metta. May I be happy. And again, when we do the metta practice, we have to be focused about it. We start with the words. Say the words clearly. Enunciate them to oneself. Repeatedly, evenly, steadily. That's the first thing. Simply repeating the words. Do that as best as you can. Bring a sense of care, a sense of craftsmanship to that. So this word kusala, we translate as skillful, like craftsmanship. It's used to mean like a skilled craftsman. So bring this sense of craftsmanship to your meditation. Become an expert. Train yourself repeatedly, slowly, carefully, diligently in the foundations of your practice. You're here to be contemplatives. This is the prime focus of our monastery. It's a forest monastery, it's a meditation monastery. Each one of you has a sincere interest in meditation practice. That's why you're here. So become good at it. Practice it, like if you wanted to become a skilled pianist, you practice your scales, you practice your fingerings, you practice your arpeggios. And I wouldn't expect to just be able to sit down and doodle around at the piano for a while and then come up with something good. Of course, the frustrating thing is that some people can. Some people are naturally gifted as musicians and they can just sit there and doodle around and come up with something good. So we're not like that. Most of us need that grounding. If we find we just intuitively sit down and go into jhana or something like that, then terrific. You don't need to worry about meditation methods. Just sit there and go into jhana. Whoopee. Right? If we don't do that, we need to ground ourselves. We need to do the homework. So take care with that. If that's all you do, then that's already pretty good. That's already fulfilling the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samasankhapa. And all the time that you're sitting there thinking, may I be happy, then you're not having wrong thoughts, you're not having harmful thoughts. You can keep doing that for the rest of your life and it won't cause any harm. And this was the reflection which the Buddha made, recorded in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, where he said that if he could just keep on thinking these thoughts of harmlessness, the thoughts of metta, and it would never bring any harm at all to anyone. But if he kept on thinking them, then he couldn't bring his mind to samadhi. So he had to find a way also to transcend those thoughts. Now when we are talking about developing samadhi, remember the five jhana factors: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. Initial application, sustained application, rapture, bliss and one-pointedness. When we're developing a metta meditation, we are developing each of these factors, trying to develop them all in a balanced way. So we have to pay attention to how each of these factors arises and is developed within the meditation. In vitakka we're developing when we bring up the words, may I be happy. The vichara we develop when we keep on going with them evenly. The next jhana factor is the piti, the rapture. So we have to look inside and try to find what kind of emotional response that we're having to this meditation. And this emotional response will arise when our intention is pure. So here we're not just saying the words, may I be happy, not just repeating them by rote, but we also have an understanding. We feel the meaning of the words in our heart. Now if you really are doing that, if you really are saying those words with purity and with the right intention, then that feeling of metta will be the feelings associated with the thoughts. It's conditioned by them. If you don't believe me, try doing the opposite experiment. Instead of doing may I be happy, you just say to yourself, think of the person you hate most in the world, and just think to yourself, die you bastard, die you bastard, die you bastard. And think of all the mean things that they've done. And then you'll find that when you think like that the feeling of anger arises very quickly. You can't really say those words and really mean them without having the feeling of anger arising. Of course you can say it as a joke and the feeling doesn't arise. But if you really mean it, then that feeling's going to arise. So it's the same thing with metta. If you're saying those words, you'll be happy. If you're really meaning them, then without a doubt that feeling of metta is going to arise. So what if it doesn't? What if you're sitting there doing the metta meditation and you can't feel anything? So this is really the critical juncture, one of the critical junctures in the metta practice. What do you do when there's no feeling? There's no response from the meditation. So this then becomes an area which is very personal, very idiosyncratic. Some people, the feeling of metta just comes up very easily, straight away. Others, it will come up occasionally, sometimes, but not other times. Some people, it won't come at all. And there's at least two kinds of problems here. One problem is when you're saying the words of metta and trying to develop it and so on, but really there's some underlying emotional conflict or problem which is undercutting the feeling of metta, stopping it from arising. So if that's the case, then you need to go back to the first stage, which is mindful awareness. Deepen your awareness, deepen your sense of equanimity. Become more conscious of any negative habits of thought, emotional patterns. And sort them out. If it's just a temporary thing, a passing thing, then just be aware of it, allow it to fade into equanimity, come back and start again. If it's something which is more ingrained, more like a personality trait or characteristic, then you probably want to start doing some regular antidote practices, regular practices that will specifically target that particular problem and work to overcome it. Okay, so notice these two different kinds of things that we use in meditation. We compare it with, say, looking after the body, looking after the health of the body. When our body is reasonably healthy and okay, when it doesn't have any major kinds of illnesses, then we don't need to take any medicines for it. Okay. So these days we've been conditioned sometimes to think that we need to take medicines even when we're not sick. So we're popping vitamin pills and so on, which I think are very good, extremely good for the health of the companies that make the vitamins. The fact that they actually increase people's death rate is neither here nor there, but if you want to give your life to increase the drug company's profits, then that's very compassionate of you. You might just consider just save yourself the bother of actually taking the pills and just make them a donation if you want to. So the reality is actually we shouldn't be taking medicines if we're not sick. If we're not sick, we eat reasonable food, get a reasonable amount of exercise, do some meditation, drink clean water. Have good friends and good company. And live a good life, a happy, positive life. And that's the healthiest thing that we can do. If we are sick, then again, we use that, just our common sense. If something arises which is just a minor little thing, then we don't have to do much about it. Get a little cut, or we just put a band-aid on it. Clean it and put a band-aid on it. Get a little bit of a cold or something like that, we'll just take a bit of a rest. So these things are not things which, they're just ordinary things. You don't have to worry about them too much. And of course, if we have something which is more serious, illness or injury, then we need to look after that with some specific corrective, some specific medicine. So the same thing in a meditation practice. If our mind's reasonably healthy, the problems are just ordinary, you know, problems, we get annoyed sometimes, or you know, we get greedy sometimes or something like that, that's ordinary things. They're not things to be worried about too much. And we just deal with them with ordinary meditation practice. But then if we've got specific problems which we need to deal with, specific destructive emotional patterns, specific traumas we have to deal with, specific areas of confusion, like we go into certain places and then just a fear arise or something like that, then we need to deal with those with specific countermeasures, and we need to do them persistently over a long period of time. Those countermeasures might mean something you can do in meditation, might mean a specific kind of reflection or a specific meditative approach, might mean something that's done outside of meditation, might mean some kind of counselling, or you need to speak with somebody about it, or whatever it might be. So you need to know the difference between these things. So don't go running off to the doctor every time you get a sniffle. You ignore when you have a serious illness. So this is one of the main things that we have to learn, especially in the first few years of our meditation, is to learn the difference between these things. What's the difference between just something that just comes and goes, and it's not such a big deal, and what's something that's quite important and needs to be looked at. This is our wisdom faculty that knows the difference between these things. So I was talking about the reasons why sometimes we can't get the feeling of metta going. And so I mentioned that sometimes it's because there's some our practice of equanimity isn't purified and we have some underlying emotional blockage. In other cases, that's not really the issue. In other cases, the issue is more a problem of perception. It's more simply that we don't notice it. We're not conditioned to see the feeling of metta. That it's actually there in a sense, but we're not looking in the right place. So that's, you know, think of it a little bit like you're hunting for a radio station on the dial. So if you know that there's a particular station you're looking for, it's there, the radio waves are there in the atmosphere, but you haven't quite found them yet. So you keep on looking. So that's something to investigate, to see in your practice. Reflect. Have a look into it. See whether you can see the feeling of metta. Maybe you think it's not there, but maybe it is there actually. Maybe it's hiding. Now when you first get the feeling of metta going in your meditation, I know for myself, certainly the first thing you do is get very excited. Like, wow, it's amazing. You know, this is possible. To turn you to know it's possible for me, they get quite excited about it. Of course, that excitement then makes the mind unsettled, and then the feeling of metta goes again. And you think, oh, well, try again. So again, that's showing the lack of equanimity. Now that experience with the excitement coming up, that will stay with you all the way. And that's that same thing which will be the last obstacle which will stop you from getting into jhanas. It's that excitability of the mind. When you first feel the feeling of metta, you'll feel that excited response. Then that's at a fairly coarse level. It's not difficult to learn to reflect on that, to develop equanimity and go beyond that. That's quite straightforward. But each time you deepen your practice, each stage that the mind drops down to, each level that the mind enters into, then that excitability will re-emerge again and again at each more subtle layer. And each time, the mind's getting more subtle, but it's also getting more powerful. So the more powerful it gets, and that excitability will still keep on coming up. So when you learn to recognize that, when you see that, then reflect on it. Oh, okay, that's why I've got to develop that equanimity practice before the meditation. The fact that excitability is there shows me that my equanimity is not deep enough yet. And that, as I said before, it's very likely for many meditators that it's precisely that excitability that is the last obstacle before getting into jhana. The mind wants to go into unification and gets excited about it. So we leave that excited feeling behind when the feeling of metta arises inside the body. Now, one thing that's very important to remember here is that the feeling of metta should always be localized, should always be grounded, or should always be embodied. It's not just a woofly emotion which just drifts around the atmosphere. It's one that happens here, in this very body. In the mevakayam. So there's nothing esoteric or complicated about that. It just means that you're paying attention inside your body when the feeling comes up. And when the feeling arises, when it first arises, it will be, when it arises, it will be a mixture of piti and sukha. These two things, piti and sukha, rapture and bliss, they always come together. Okay, so you never perceive them or experience them separately until you get to third jhana, when the piti falls away and only sukha is left. Okay, so until that time, they're always mixed up. And yet you can tell a slight difference in the quality of them. The piti, rapture, has this uplifting, thrilling quality. Sukha has this tranquilizing, settling quality. So the first thing to do when you feel this feeling of metta arising in the body is just to very gently cup the feeling in the mind, holding it very carefully. Just imagine like if you were holding a little baby. Just holding it very close, holding it in your arms. If you're holding a little baby, a newborn baby, you'd be very careful, you wouldn't let it go, wouldn't let it come to any danger. But you'd know that you couldn't hold it too tight. Can't be hard about it. Very, very gentle. Now, one of the wonderful and extraordinary qualities of meditation, especially of metta meditation, is that when we bring our awareness to this wholesome and joyous object in the right way, with the right quality of attention, that feeling, that object starts to feed back. It starts to grow by itself. It responds to that positive attention that we're giving it.